It's November 7th, 2007. This is Mike Benedetti of PieandCoffee.org, and I'm here talking with Ken Hannaford-Riccardi and Scott Schaefer-Duffy. These gentlemen and five other people were arrested at the Sudanese embassy in Washington, D.C. in 2005 for protesting the Darfur genocide by blocking the entrance to the embassy. And most people who have done that, including myself, paid a $50 fine and went on with our lives, but this group decided to push things to a trial, and they were found guilty in court in 2005. They appealed it, and now in the fall of 2007, they went back to talk about their appeal yesterday. Ken, how did it go?
The actual court proceeding was really interesting. Three of us out of the seven, we was sat down in front of the judges who we were so close to them. When you looked up, it looked like you had to scale a mountain. Scott made the presentation for us. I think he made a very reasoned and impassioned presentation. Two of the judges looked barely interested, and one, I think, was openly antagonistic.
Did he throw things, or how did he display this?
When they're allowed to ask questions, instead of asking substantive questions, he just made remarks to show that he knew a little something or knew a little bit of, or knew somebody. It had, like he said, he knew Rosa Parks. You know, Scott had brought up Rosa Parks. He said, I knew Rosa Parks. And when Scott brought up an example of running into a burning building and not being charged with jaywalking or trespass in order to save somebody, the judge said, well, if we had the time, I'd engage in a colloquy with you on that matter, you know. And he didn't ask any substantive questions. He just gave these little zingers, and I think it was kind of an arrogant type thing to show that I know things that you don't. I wasn't impressed.
Did that judge say he saved somebody from a burning building, though? No, I didn't think so.
No. And the other two judges looked politely there.
They were just there. Scott, how did you think it went?
Well, of course, of the seven of us, Ken would call an acquittal a catastrophe.
And the Eeyore of
yeah,
the category.
Ken, you know, Ken is, and I'm kind of close to it, so it's hard for me to say. The particular judge he's talking about was Judge Warren King, who sat in the center. He's an African-American justice, and he, as Ken said, did interrupt with questions. But this is the second time I've done this. This is the form. That's what they do. And
this is the second time that you've gone and done an oral argument.
Yeah, an oral argument for an appeal. Right, and that's what they do. They ask questions. So it's a bad sign when they don't ask questions.
We should point out, too, that you're not lawyers. You guys are representing yourselves.
No, exactly. And and you only have 15 minutes to speak. And there's a little clock in front of you on the podium, you know, telling you what your time is. He let it go over a little bit because he did ask a couple questions. And I mentioned Rosa Parks, and he said, and I felt Ken was correct on this, there was a touch of maybe sarcasm in his voice when he said, I knew Rosa Parks. Like, you know, you young white people here in the court, don't go quoting her name. And he said, and she pleaded guilty to the charge. And I said, with as little sarcasm as I could muster, well, as it says in our brief, we recognize that. I didn't say if you read our brief, but,
right.
You know, that we recognize that she pled guilty because she was violating an unjust law. As Dr. Martin Luther King said, you should plead guilty to violating unjust laws. And in fact, Gandhi said you should ask for the maximum sentence. But in our present instance, we're not violating an unjust law. We have no objection to the law against blocking the door of someone's house. It's the context, and it's the situation, and this is why it's a necessity defense. I mean, I felt like talking to an idiot in a way. You got to explain to him, this is why we're pulling for necessity. And I used the example, I said, if someone was trying to stab someone across the street, and I crossed the street to try to stop it, and a policeman observing the entire scene arrests me for jaywalking, when it goes to court, that charge would be vacated or I would be acquitted because in the context, the breaking of that law is exonerated. That's what necessity is. And that's what we're asking you to do. Mm-hmm. And then he, of course, as Ken said, I would like to discuss that with you. And I was, you know, to say, you know, are you saying that, you know, I was tempted to say, are you trying to imply that jaywalking is is a greater crime, or that blocking the entrance of the embassy is somehow, you know, consequential compared to genocide. But I did feel, contrary to you, Ken, the two justices on either end, I didn't feel they were disinterested in board. I had eye contact with them over and over. I think they were really thinking about it. And the Ming judge, who asked all the questions, he said at one point, I said, we didn't, you know, while we thought this would be effective, we've never made the claim that it would be self-sufficient, that the demonstration would stop the genocide in and of itself. And the judge said something like, would that it could. And I said something like, amen to that, absolutely.
Right.
You know, and but I did stress to him, and I think he heard this, that everything we've done is from the moment we did the went to Darfur to the moment we did the civil disobedience to the moment we refused to pay the $50 and went to overnight in jail and went to court and decided to appeal right to the moment we were doing the oral argument yesterday. All of this is still a chain of us trying to be an efficient responder to genocide and try to get the whole society, the courts, the government, and everything to respond. And I told the judge, and I still have hopes that this panel can be part of this efficient chain, and if not here, a higher panel, alluding to we will certainly appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court.
That's the next step from these guys?
Yes, it is. And that we would definitely appeal. Now, these U.S. Supreme Court, according to our advising lawyer who was there, Robert Hollander, they get about 900 cases a year, and they agree to hear a few dozen. So most cases that go before them, they don't hear them, so they can just let the previous decision stand. So it would be, you know, better to have a decision here.
Right.
You know, but Mr. Hollander, who was there, and he was the randomly selected advising lawyer at the day of our arrest.
And he's been super helpful to you.
He has. He's been very, very nice, very supportive, and given some tips here and there, and just a wonderful guy. And he, when we left the court, he was effusive. He thought it couldn't have gone better. Mm-hmm. He felt the justices on the ends were intrigued, and he thought there was a very good possibility that one or two of them could vote to overturn.
Mm.
He agreed with Ken that the middle judge was against us, but he said that they probably never had an argument like this one.
Yeah.
He was just effusive, right, in his optimism and in his willingness to help us with the appeal to the Supreme Court should it come to that.
I was surprised by the prosecution.
Yes,
I was waiting for her 15 minutes, and she stood up and uttered one sentence to the effect that she got up and she said something to the effect that the government feels that the necessity defense does not apply here. Do you have any questions? None of them had a question. They said thank you. And the whole her whole presentation, plus asking them if they had any questions, did not take 30 seconds.
It's a good use of the government's time.
Well, she... I introduced myself to her in the beginning because I had spoken to her on the phone, and I talked to her for a little bit, just pleasantries. And she had asked for three extensions. She's part of the reason why this is taking so long. It's 2 years after the arrest.
February 5th, 2005.
Right, so it's more than 2 years after the arrest, and more than 2 years after the trial.
Yeah.
And she asked for three extensions to file her material. And the material she did file... It wasn't that detailed.
Mm-hmm.
It was nowhere near as long as the brief we filed, and nowhere near as many citations. And like the last time I appealed a civil disobedience case, there's almost an arrogance that we're are arguing orally. We do a substantial brief and a reply brief, and we ask for the oral argument, and they don't even have to respond.
Mm-hmm. They just say, whatever, forget these.
Well, my son Aiden and I were reading about the trial, about the sentencing and trial of Robert Emmett, the Irish patriot. And at one point he says, the judge is chiding him in his pre-sentencing statement before they executed him. And he said, this is a show trial. At least let me make my statement before you execute me. He says, this decision was made before the jury was impaneled. And you could almost feel the prosecutor... as a lawyer, talking to the judges who are lawyers, saying, this is a pro se appeal, you know, we just don't know. Now, the other possibility, and I didn't get the chance to talk to her, was that she decided not to reply to the rebuttal brief and not to make an argument is that she's an African-American woman, too. Perhaps she was a little sympathetic.
And she said, you know, we shouldn't try to fight this thing too
hard.
Let's
not fight this thing hard.
It might be nice if these guys got
off. Yes, maybe it was a sympathetic thing.
Yeah.
You know, we really...
Don't know.
Don't know. And, you know, as Ken said, you know, it was an emotional as well as intellectual appeal to these judges. And certainly cases were cited. And I made an oblique reference to a couple of times to the brief itself in the hopes that, crying out loud, that the justices will read the briefs.
Mm-hmm.
Because oftentimes only clerks read the briefs. They have to be particularly interested to go back and read the briefs. I mean, if they had to make a decision whether or not to overturn this case on the basis of the 15 minutes that I spoke yesterday, I would say they wouldn't do it.
But if they read the brief, then...
But if they heard those 15 minutes and read the brief and the rebuttal brief, I'd say, and Mr. Hollander felt, which is more important because he's a professional lawyer and I'm not, he felt there was a good chance that there could be a 2-1 decision, which would be a favorable decision.
Well, guys, good luck. Thanks for talking to me. Ken and Scott, I'll talk to you later.
Okay,
great.